Shalom, and welcome to another in our ongoing series of podcasts here on JewishSacredAging.com. I am Richard Address, and I thank you for joining us. These podcasts are designed to focus on a variety of issues that are impacting Jewish elders, our families, and our community. And we appreciate your comments and suggestions to Rabbi Address at JewishSacredAging.com. And now, with pleasure, we welcome to our podcast microphones Rabbi Jeff Salkin. Jeffrey, thank you for joining us. Welcome to Jewish Sacred Aging Podcasts. And how are you today?
I'm good. It's good to be with you today, Richard.
We're going to talk about your brand new book, Jewish Publication Society, B'nai Mitzvah Torah Commentary, and really some of the implications of why you wrote it, and to really speak to our audience as well, some of the implications of bar, bat mitzvahs, grandparenting, stuff like that. But let's just get to the basics right away. Talk to me about this new Torah commentary. It's been a while. I think you told me like 25 years since your Putting God on the Guest List came out, which sort of like started some of this bar, bat mitzvah reevaluation, reimagining revolution. What drove you to the Torah commentary?
Well, Richard, you're right in mentioning Putting God on the Guest List. That came out 25 years ago. It was published by Jewish Lights. I'm proud to say that it was a game changer in the way that American Jews dealt with bar mitzvah and bat mitzvah. My point in that book was that we had been spiritually sleepwalking through one of the greatest passages of a Jew's life, that we had simultaneously put too much importance upon it, and we had, in some cases, trivialized it, spending too much money on celebration, etc. 25 years later, with the JPS B'nai Mitzvah Torah commentary, I took up the project again because I had noticed that this passage is still extremely relevant to young Jews and to their families, but there had been a lack of curiosity about what the passages of Torah and the Haftarot, the prophetic passages, really mean. I wanted to address that lack of curiosity and show people that there is more here than we had ever thought.
So, you know, when you say more here than we had ever thought, let's be honest, the current trend in a lot of bar bat mitzvah ceremonies, you know, the old joke in the rabbinate is more emphasis on the bar and less emphasis on the mitzvah. What as you research this and you know, your own congregational experience, how much of an uphill struggle is this? Is this still with it? I mean, it just seems to be we're fighting a cultural issue here of celebration rather than meaning. What are you finding?
I think it's absolutely necessary, Richard, for Jews to become cultural warriors in this battle. I think 25 years after I wrote Putting God on the Guest List, I've seen that the forces of secular culture and contemporary culture really have been waging a war against what we Jews are trying to promote within our own synagogues. It's not only the amount of money and the attention to celebration. Frankly, I've seen that wane in recent years. I think as the economy has shifted, people have less money for that. But what I have seen is an increased dropout rate on the part of kids after bar mitzvah, often not because they don't care about Judaism, but because their pressures from school are so intense. I have seen that we don't have the communities that we used to have, so there's far less communal Velcro. There has been a radical drop-off in affiliation. You and I have discussed this. And then there's the Internet, which has made it possible for many people to get everything they need or they think they need from Judaism from their iPhone. So these are all significant battles. What I want to be able to say to people is that in this text, in these stories, in these teachings, in these laws, there is a great deal that can actually make your life better.
And so in the context, the content, rather, of the new B'nai Mitzvah commentary, you stream or sort of like bring together contemporary issues and traditional commentaries. Walk us through how you do that.
Well, what I did was I set for myself a particular discipline. I wrote two Divrei Torah in kids speak. for each Torah portion. And then I wrote a Dvar Haftarah, a commentary on the prophetic or historical passage that is part of the scriptural reading as well. By the way, that's radically new. The Haftarah has been, forgive me, the ugly cousin of the service. It is often an afterthought, or in some cases it's just read in English. I believe that we Jews have to recapture the meaning of the messages of the prophets. The discipline I set for myself was to have one classical commentator and one contemporary commentator. And sometimes those contemporary commentators are not Jews. I quote George Carlin. I quote various rock songs in the commentary. And by the way, that's not easy, because nothing is as dated as a document that has bad cultural references or references that no one would know anymore. I have to realize that things change so quickly. I also, by the way, adopted a particular discipline that I think many of your listeners will understand and agree with. So many Torah commentaries are male-oriented or written by men. I try to establish myself a commentary discipline that there would be many women rabbis, cantors, educators, and thinkers who would be represented in these pages, not only because I believe in justice, but also because I believe that our young women need positive, Jewishly educated, and wise role models in order to make their lives meaningful.
Give me, this has been out, when was this published, Jeff?
Came out in March.
March of 2017. Have you gotten any feedback from families who've used this?
Families are loving it. My colleagues are loving it. People are saying that finally there is something that speaks to young people in ways that they can understand and relate to. One of the issues that I had, Richard, and I think I've always had this, is how do you translate this ancient arcane culture into a language that kids can really understand and appreciate? And I came to understand something. Our kids have shown themselves very capable of living in imaginary worlds. Our kids watch Game of Thrones. Our kids know the stories of The Hobbit, Lord of the Rings, etc. Our kids can live in fantasy worlds. So in some ways, I tried to create Biblical Judaism as another fantasy world that still has relevance to us today.
So that's an interesting juxtaposition. How do you do that? How do you open the door to seeing Biblical Judaism as a fantasy world?
Well, for example, one of the things that I say over and over again is that the relevance of the Torah is that it speaks to the way we live our lives. And in fact, human nature really hasn't progressed very far since Cain killed Abel. So it's not only the stories that have relevance, but also, believe it or not, even some of the stuff in Leviticus, which is often laughed at or frowned upon by rabbis and educators, issues of ritual impurity and skin diseases. But I say to kids, look, we think that death is yucky. We think that having a blemish on your skin, a zit, is a reason to worry socially as to whether you'll be found acceptable in your crowd. Don't you think our ancestors worried about this stuff as well? And look at how they tried to resolve those issues.
Just to play around with some things, 13-year-old kids now, is bar bat mitzvah, is it, should we push it back to some of the old original concepts of moving it back to 16? Kids are a little bit more mature, you think?
Oh, gosh. A number of years ago, I had an idea that we should completely ditch bar mitzvah and bat mitzvah, and even confirmation, and create a rite of passage that is much more, I think, coherent in today's society. No 13-year-old kid is ready for responsibility. Maybe they can choose their snack or their sneakers with parental guidance, but that's about it. The real rite of passage in America today, as you and I know, is 17 or 18, when you graduate from high school and when you leave the house, when you really do a lechacha, go forth from your father's house, as God said to Abraham. In my fantasy world, I would recreate a whole new way of looking at Judaism and Torah and make the graduation from high school into the ritual moment that in today's society it really should be.
You know, I could see somebody trying to do this in the congregation, you know, bar mitzvah at 13, a confirmation at 16, and graduation and lech hachaim at 17 or 18. Could be very interesting because, as you know, and all of our colleagues know, the theological perspective of a kid who's 13 is usually very different when they walk out of the high school and get ready to go to college or not even go to college, as some of our kids do. And, you know, that whole challenge of, well, how come you're not going to college? What do you mean you're not going to college? Everybody else is expected to.
That's really interesting. First of all, you and I both are products of and have served the Reform movement for our entire lives and our entire professional careers. I think, Richard, you and I would agree that one of the great innovations of Reform Judaism was to say that 13 is too young for religious maturity, and therefore we are raising the age of maturity to the age of confirmation, which is 15 or 16, and then even beyond that. But what's interesting to me is I've noticed, perhaps since moving to Florida, and also when I lived in other places in the South, that not every Jewish kid goes to college.
Correct. It's the great myth.
Some kids, I'm proud to say, choose to enter the military. Some kids just decide to go out into the work world. We need to honor those kids as much as we honor kids who are about to go to Yale.
Right. So that, you know, that raises the issue, which I'm sure you've thought about, and other perhaps colleagues as well, about, you know, how do you make a ritual that celebrates life's choices, even if those choices may run counter to what the popular mythology is? Because I know kids from the last congregation I served who did go into the military or who chose not to go to. They basically said, I don't think I'm ready to go. I need a year or two to work or to travel. And so the whole thing right now is perhaps up for grabs, which really goes back to the book and goes back to the focus on this ceremony, this rather interesting ceremony of Bar Bat Mitzvah. And as you said, you don't know any 13-year-old kids who are really to understand the concept of responsibility. So then what's it all about?
Well, you know something, it's interesting. I'm going back now to what our ancestors knew about bar mitzvah, even before there was bat mitzvah. One of the things that I wrote about and put in God on the Guest List is the prayer that fathers used to say when their sons became bar mitzvah, which in translation is, "Blessed is the one who has freed me from responsibility for this kid," which doesn't mean that I'm washing my hands of the situation. Doesn't mean let him do whatever he wants. I think what it means in a deep, profound way is that as our kids enter adolescence and as they move through adolescence, we come to realize how little the power is that we have over them. We have influence. We can teach them, but we do not have absolute power to mold them. Rabbi Harold Schulweis of blessed memory once said that we can't put our heads on our kids' shoulders, and so we have to salute their autonomy and their ability to make decisions that may not actually fly in the way that we would have wanted them to act. And yet, we understand that those kids deserve blessings. Just as Esau said to his father Isaac when Jacob got blessed, you know, Esau, this big, tough guy, you know, "Father, have you only one blessing for me?" We have to have blessings for all of our kids.
That's the, you know, the Schulweis thing. He has this wonderful poem in one of his collections. I think it's In God's Mirror, of this poem called Holding On and Letting Go. And we teach a lot of it dealing with older adult stuff, but also as a parent, and every parent knows that you start that process almost from the time of birth of trying to hold on to what was or is and the need to let go and allow somebody to be independent human being. And so, you know, the Bar Bat Mitzvah is part of that. It's part of that step. It's part of that progression of holding on and letting go. Let me refocus on because you raise, Jeff, this whole concept. And I think in the introduction to the book, you write about it as well, about this issue of responsibility. And you said no 13-year-old can really understand the concept of responsibility. But yet responsibility, especially in this day and age, is becoming increasingly more important as a concept and as a practice. How do we begin to talk about that and teach that when, as you mentioned before, the statistics are telling you that so many of our young people get off the bima on bar or bat mitzvah and we don't see them again for maybe 20 years?
Well, look, it's a two-pronged project here, Richard. Number one, I really have to say that most synagogues that I know of and most synagogues that I have served do an excellent job of trying to retain kids into their teenage years. But I also think that what sociologists have said to us has to be heeded, in particular Professor Stephen Cohen of Hebrew Union College Jewish Institute of Religion, which is that we have to multiply the ways that kids can connect to the synagogue and to the Jewish community in the adolescent years. But then there's a second prong to that, which is that we really have to engage in, well, in some ways it's very countercultural, a way of discussing with parents that we want you to want this as well. That it can't all be just directed from the kids. There is a kind of laissez-faire attitude that I've noticed for the entirety of my career where parents will say, well, if my kid wants to, well, I want you to want your kids to want that. I tell parents it is okay to have Jewish expectations of your kids the same way you would have secular expectations of your kids. And in some ways, it's about creating a mental photograph album and then just getting ready to take the photographs of those particular moments. I am, for example, very proud of a young woman in my congregation who was so moved by her experience in Israel last summer that she decided to accelerate her high school experience. She is graduating a year early from high school, and she's doing a gap year in Israel next summer. We have to encourage that. We have to celebrate that, and we have to make it possible. But we have to teach parents to value that as well.
So in this whole vein of modeling behavior, parents, I want to move into your perception of how important the role of the grandparent is in the issue of responsibility, of modeling behavior and having expectations, Jewish expectations of that grandchild that perhaps the mom and dad do not have in the same way. How does the grandparent use the B'nai Mitzvah Torah and commentary?
Well, I'm really glad you asked that question. First of all, I think we have to remember what sociologists have told us. I mentioned one sociologist, Stephen Cohen, moments ago, but I keep thinking about something I heard from the late lamented Professor Gary Tobin, who was one of the great American Jewish sociologists who died before his time and before anyone's time. Gary once said that the influence that grandparents have over kids is second only to the influence that parents have. I think many grandparents don't realize how important they are in the lives of their grandchildren. My friend, the Jewish educator and author Joel Grisaver, says that grandparents have the ability to be, I love this image, anti-mame, you know, that sort of playful figure in their grandchildren's lives that even their parents are not capable of being. I think that grandparents have the ability to show their grandchildren different aspects of Jewish life, to show them what it was like from their perspective when they were growing up. And we really have to be honest. My grandparents, well, they would have spoken Yiddish if I had asked them to. I think they were of the generation that wanted to forget their Yiddish. But we don't have Bubby and Zeta anymore. We actually have, I think we're even beyond Mom and Pop. You know, it's probably just Jack and Shirley at this point. We have to re-imbue grandparents with the sense that they are teachers. They are role models. I think of how my own kids are so connected to their grandparents. We can't waste this valuable resource in the lives of Jewish kids.
Yeah, my sense is, and I've been observing this in my travels and work with Jewish Sacred Aging, that the baby boomer population of grandparents, very, very involved in many ways with their grandchildren, even if they're not local. And in many ways, guardians of the tradition, almost a sense of saying, you know, it's our generation that really, really must preserve the tradition. So, you know, in many congregations, when they stand at the ark for the Bar Bat Mitzvah and pass the Torah from generation to generation, there's a real opportunity there from, I think, to heighten the role modeling and also the storytelling of that grandparent generation to, because so many boomers were involved in cultural change in this country that is lost right now on a lot of the kids. They just, you know, they just, for good reason, they just don't understand it. They didn't live it. But I'm fascinated by the fact that there's ways or how grandparents can be the real preservers of tradition and, in essence, the architects in many ways of a Jewish identity that has perhaps escaped their adult children as parents, or that the parents themselves just don't see or don't have the time for.
You're really making me think deeply about this, Richard. So, for example, my kids have experiences with their grandparents in which their grandfathers in particular were able to regale them with stories of fighting in World War II.
Mm-hmm.
My kids also have had a grandfather who was a Holocaust survivor and who was capable of passing on that legacy to them. But now let's move it forward. So you and I, well, you're a little bit older than I am, you and I grew up in the 60s. We grew up at a time of great social turbulence in this country. That means that we have the ability to teach that legacy to our kids because, let's face it, I think it's clear that we're in a moment in American history where the need for activism mirrors and echoes what you and I experienced when we were young. And those are stories that we should tell, because if those stories get lost, then an opportunity for great engagement would be lost as well.
Jeff, in your opinion, because you write, you have a blog. Why don't you mention you write the blog, which is?
It's called Martini Judaism, for those who want to be shaken and stirred. And it is published several times a week by the Religion News Service.
Yes.
I write about politics. I write about culture. In fact, this week, I'm really proud to say this, the first time an article of mine was translated into Spanish, I wrote a whole article, a reflection on the Batman story as a metaphor for Jewish history. And, of course, focusing on the death of Adam West.
Of Batman. So you write about this, you comment on this, not only from the particular perspective of tradition, but from contemporary culture. But you also, because of your writing and your scholar in residence work and your work in the community at large, if Bar and Bat Mitzvah, an attempt in your book to reconstruct or revitalize this ceremony, how much is this part of a total need to transition or transform the contemporary American non-Orthodox community? Is this part of a larger issue of American Jewish transformation?
I think, Richard, it is a very important piece of the puzzle. I can't imagine the revitalization of American Jewish life without the revitalization of Bar Mitzvah and Bat Mitzvah. In fact, 25 years ago, I mused to myself and to others that we could actually fix American Judaism if we only fixed Bar Mitzvah and Bat Mitzvah. One big, fat dayenu that would be enough. If, for example, if we only got a significant number of kids to continue their Jewish education and involvement and engagement beyond puberty, dayenu, we could fix this. We could completely change the American Jewish future. Look at what Birthright has done already. But imagine if it had not been necessary to do that. Look, I'm a Zionist. I love Israel. I'm preparing a trip to Israel in a few weeks. I'm taking more than 30 of my congregants to Israel. I'm spending the whole month in Israel. My Zionist street cred is pretty strong. But what does it say about the American Jewish community, Richard, that we have to export our kids, we have to put them on planes to introduce them to a quality Jewish experience in which time and space is entirely Jewish? Doesn't this in some way testify to the spiritual impoverishment of our own community?
And is that why the Jewish camping movement continues to be one of the strongest lights in our community as other parts of the community sort of like drift away?
25 years ago, my friends Rob and Elisa Bildner founded the Foundation for Jewish Camp. And they believed, and I agreed with them, and experience has borne us out, that camping is an important part. In fact, it is a crucial part of American Jewish continuity efforts, and it was not being honored enough, and that meant that not enough money was flowing into it. I think when we expose our kids to what I would call immersive Jewish experiences, not even my term, yes, Jewish summer camp, yes, Israel during the high school years, I wish that more kids were going to Jewish day schools. I wish, look, this, here's another issue. Ready?
Mm-hmm.
Jewish experiences are expensive. And you're asking me, well, how do we get grandparents involved? Well, isn't it interesting that the boomers are about to inherit a lot of money from an earlier generation? What would it be like if people of our age and a little bit older who are about to become a little bit more prosperous than they would have expected, if they could donate some of that money and set aside some of that money for the Jewish experiences of their own grandchildren? It's happening already, but more of that could be happening.
Yeah, and that I know, because every single one of my friends who are in this position are writing those checks. And partly because their children, because of the economy and the shift in the economic status of the Gen Xers, in many ways just can't afford all the stuff that you need to afford to operate, in a fulfilled Jewish environment. Because as you alluded to send two kids to camp, perhaps a day school, to pay your synagogue dues, to contribute to the Federation and join the JCC, is a significant amount of money. And I do know that this is another reason why I think the grandparent issue is so not so subtly interesting, because a lot of our generation are writing those checks specifically because we want those grandchildren to have that Jewish experience, because that's part of the transition and the transmission of Jewish heritage and culture.
Absolutely right.
Yeah, and this is part of this whole reconstruction or refiguring or transformation of, and the economy has lots to do with it. And I think it's another issue that rarely gets discussed on a substantive level. I mean, you can go to a conference and there's always a workshop on it. But on a substantive level, it's a real challenge. I don't know the answer to the question either. I wish I did. Your perspective, Jeff, in writing and teaching and working in a congregation, putting forth a lot of these ideas, what's been the reaction of lay leadership? Is this to say, that's really good, Rabbi, you go and do it? Or that's really good, Rabbi, we're going to help you and invest our time and resources in this revitalization?
At my current congregation, which is Temple Solel in Hollywood, Florida, I believe that there has been a growing desire on the part of lay leadership to partner with me to make these things happen. Certainly, we have been part of a revolutionary process in the life of the congregation in involving our kids in ways that they had not been involved before. We also, by the way, have been part of a very important social movement. We have actually spearheaded a Jewish response to sea level rise, which, as you might know, in South Florida is a major lethal challenge that we face. So we've started two coalitions. The one that's larger within the Reform community is called the Higher Ground Initiative, Because one of the things that we've enlisted kids and congregants into understanding is that with climate change, global warming, and sea level rise, the vast majority of American Jews who happen to live 10 or 15 miles from a coastline will be affected by this. So the way to answer your question is there's been a growing sense of partnership and concern, certainly among leaders. Every congregation right now that I know of is going through demographic shifts. In some cases, those are promising. In some cases, those are very challenging. I don't think it is radical or heretical to say that, and you and I, we talk about this right all the time, is that no synagogue today is going to be the same 20 years from now. And there are only two choices. You can get ahead of the curve or you can be swallowed up by, forgive me, the rising waters of apathy and American secularism and commercialism. I think that many synagogues really want to be leaders and not just be led.
No, I agree. And as I used to tell a congregation, that I'm many congregations, that if you continue to do the things you've always done and continue to do it, you will be irrelevant within a generation. And I think, as you say, we're starting to see that. So, before we conclude, somebody wants the book. How do we get a hold of the JPS B'nai Mitzvah Torah Commentary?
Well, you can get it directly from the Jewish Publication Society on their website, or you can simply go to Amazon.com.
The great God Amazon knows all, sees all.
And it's, by the way, I've seen it in Barnes & Noble as well. By the way, I'm really proud of this book. It is physically beautiful. It contains questions that parents and grandparents can ask their kids about the Torah portions. It is designed to invest the entire family in the larger Jewish story.
Yeah, and I think that's an important comment, too, that this is a family systems approach, not just the kids sitting by themselves. And you offer them a variety of different interpretations and approaches. Even I think you say, you know, sit down and write a letter to Moses or something like that.
Well, I say something very important from an educational perspective, which is that not every kid is going to write the standard Dvar Torah. I have to laugh, you know. On Saturday Night Live, there's been the recurring character of Jacob the Bar Mitzvah boy.
Right.
And, you know, what makes him, actually played by an actress, so funny is that everything is scripted. He is not capable of having a conversation without going back to the script and making cheesy remarks that are designed to elicit laughs from his loved ones. Not every kid is going to give a standard Dvar Torah. So I say to kids, write an open letter to someone in the text. Tell the story from another person's perspective. In the story of the golden calf, tell the story from the perspective of the calf. Imagine that you're the broken tablets. Write a newspaper article. Write a piece of, you know, write a play. Write a poem. Create a piece of art. Write a song. I want kids to own this, and I think congregations would be ready for kids to, in fact, exhibit their own creativity over the process and the product.
Jeff, in closing, if you had one piece of advice to give congregational leadership and colleagues dealing with the revitalization of Bar and Bat Mitzvah, what it would be?
I would remind them of Woody Allen's line, 90% of life is just showing up. And I tell parents all the time, the more time and energy and personal presence you invest in this, the more your kids will get out of it. Look at the big picture. What do you want your kids to remember 40 years from now? And then create that memory.
Thank you, Jeff. And continued good luck. Hatzlacha and Nesiah Tova in Israel. And
Thank you.
Continued good luck with what you're doing. It's great.
It's a privilege to hang with you today. Thanks, Richard.
Hey, babe. To all of you, thank you again for listening to our ongoing series of Jewish Sacred Aging podcasts. We appreciate your time and again remind you that you can contact us at rabbiaddress@jewishsacredaging.com. All the past podcasts are archived on our website, www.jewishsacredaging.com. These programs are recorded through the facilities of Lubetkin Global Media here in Cherry Hill, New Jersey. I am Richard Address, and I look forward to greeting you on our next podcast. Thank you and shalom.